morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with an especially apt Japanese phrase, Nuchiru Takara. Life is the most precious thing. Humanity has been imprisoned within a horrible disease and death spiral of pandemic plague this past year. More than 500,000 Americans dead, several millions and more every day, increasing human mortality worldwide. 120 million cases, 2.66 million deaths so far. A French philosopher once surmised that human beings must get off planet Earth before the sun explodes. The real truth is that we have nearly ruined Earth in our robust search for enlightened existence and must soon enough seek other worlds to exploit before we are trapped to extinction. Of course, plagues have previously derailed human veracity for variable periods of time and distance. But as of yet, evolving humanoids have evaded eclipse. Chronic diseases must have racked primitive proto-humanity, but epidemics and pandemics are products of cluster and civilization through which disease is as rampant as wildfire. The more human beings, the more susceptible the aggregate to war and plague, which are products of civilization and rapacious, microbiotic cultures. Fleas, rats, and bats are persistent carriers and infestors of microscopic malignancies that have consistently toxicated humanity and intermittently set back the chronological clock, so to speak. The effect is persistent, deadly conflict between the visible and invisible germinations of organic life and death played out on massive scales. Humanity is, as so often said, it is the most original cliche, the carrier and host of its own doom. Although the numbers of epidemics throughout written history vary, Wikipedia lists 18 major epidemics by death toll and another chronological list of 300 or so by date, beginning in Babylon in 1200 BC, death toll unknown, and ending with yellow fever last year, 2020, in Nigeria, 296 dead. Communicable diseases certainly existed during hunter-gatherer epochs and most likely wiped out tribes, maybe even early ethnicities. Perhaps the worst outbreak in Western history was the bubonic plague of the middle 14th century, which was responsible for at least a third of the world's population. It infected and killed all over the globe. Known ever afterward as the Black Death, the persistent cry of bring out your dead at every house to be hauled away in carts for massive burial or pyres, rings down through the centuries, as does the nursery rhyme, ring around the rosy, a pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, all fall down. Nearly the worst pandemic of all occurred only a century ago, from 1918 to 1920. Estimates are that in its two-year duration, anywhere from 50 million humans to double that number died in Europe, Asia, the Americas, and in remote African areas, and in the Arctic North and Pacific Islands, which accounts for the incredibly large discrepancy in death counts. Yet it is considered the forgotten pandemic, essentially because it occurred concurrent to World War I, which was probably the plague's genesis and stimulus. Certainly its epidemical twin, except that nearly five times as many as the war's death casualties of 20 million KIA in half the duration were killed by the disease. The filth, decay, and rotting unburied corpses in the trenches of the Western Front might have been its cause, or germ warfare. Another reason the great influenza is relatively obscure is that the Great Depression and World War II upstaged it directly afterward. Seemingly coincidentally, the crossing over from one millennium to another has been bookended by catastrophic plagues in roughly the same years of the last century of the previous millennium and these first years of the new millennium. It is quite probable that victims of this current plague knew or were related to victims of the previous pandemic. Certainly, millions of families are linked to each. The first of the twofold pandemics might have, until recently, been hidden behind the cataclysms of world wars and financial depressions. But it is once again revealed in all its horror as humanity is stricken by similar sudden death disaster. If a single person can be made responsible for the spread of a pandemic, Donald Trump is categorically impeachable. He might not be on a scale as one of history's major monsters, but he has the despotic characteristics of greed, deceit, and especially turbulent and callous egomania. His obsessive concern with only a devastated economy and threatened chance for re-election as president resulting from the pandemic, and his failure to initially acknowledge or even organize its swarming infestation of the USA was exactly a crime against humanity and universal law that should be adjudicated by the world court. Trump, whose grandfather started the family real estate fortune owning whorehouses in Alaska during its gold rush, and died in the 1918-1920 influenza plague, acted solely for his own interest in pure despotism, which should, in the name of justice, convict him to a life sentence, breaking rocks such as he envisioned for his political enemies in the USA. And that was something I wrote. And now, by John M. Barry. Abandoning masks now is a terrible idea. The 1918 pandemic shows why. John M. Barry is the author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history, and distinguished scholar at the Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. He wrote this for the Washington Post. Abandoning masks and social distancing now would be the worst possible move for Americans and their political leaders. The 1918 pandemic teaches us why. That pandemic came in waves that were much more distinct than what we have experienced. The first wave was extraordinarily mild. The French army suffered 40,000 hospitalizations, but only about 100 deaths. The British Grand Fleet had 10,313 sailors fall ill, but only 4 deaths. Troops called it three-day fever. It was equally mild among civilians and was not nearly as transmissible as influenza normally is. Like SARS, COVID-2, the 1918 influenza virus jumped species from an animal to humans. As it infected more humans, it mutated. It became much more transmissible, sweeping across continents and oceans and penetrating everywhere. And as it became more transmissible, it caused a much, much more lethal second wave. It became the worst version of itself. The rapid spread of COVID-19 in the United States began in early 2020. A lot has changed in our day-to-day lives since then, including the use of face masks. In that second wave, the 1918 virus had an overall case mortality in the West of 2.0% to 2.5%, but that average is meaningless because it primarily killed select age groups, children under 10 and adults 20 to 50. Metropolitan Life found that of those aged 25 to 45, it killed 3.26% of all factory workers and 6.21% of all miners, and yet it barely touched the elderly. U.S. Army training camps routinely recorded case mortality over 10%. At Camp Sherman in Ohio, case mortality exceeded 21%. In 13 studies of hospitalized pregnant women, the death rate ranged from 23 to 71%. In a few isolated small settlements in Alaska and Africa, it killed everyone. Virologists expected SARS-CoV-2 to mutate more slowly than influenza, and between its emergence and November 2020, the virus did seem remarkably stable. That's why last year, when I was repeatedly asked whether I worried that SARS-CoV-2 would, like the 1918 virus, become more lethal, I always replied that even during 1918's mild first wave, that virus had on rare isolated occasions demonstrated its potential to kill, according to an Army report, from 24 to 48 hours, quote unquote. Since the SARS-CoV-2 virus had not shown any indication, none, of increased lethality, I was not concerned. But in the past several months, different variants have surfaced almost simultaneously in Britain, South Africa, Brazil, and now in California and New York. Each of these variances has independently developed similar and in some cases identical mutations and achieved greater transmissibility by binding more efficiently to human cells. A virus that binds more efficiently to cells it infects would, logic suggests, also be more likely to bind to a larger number of cells, which could, in turn, increase disease severity and lethality. BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal, reported that Britain's so-called UK variant was 64% more lethal than the virus it replaced. There is not enough data to evaluate the variants first identified in South Africa and Brazil, but whether or not they are also more lethal, one thing is certain: more variants will arise. Mutations are random. Most either make the virus so defective it can't function or have no impact at all. But this virus has already demonstrated that it can become more deadly and evade some immune protection, making vaccines less effective. If we allow the virus additional opportunities to mutate, it will have more opportunities to become the worst version of itself. There is no reason to expect that this virus will suddenly turn into 1918. There are limits as to how far it can mutate. But the more people who abandon masks and social distancing, the more infections can be expected, and the more variants will emerge. In gambling terms, if you roll the dice once, yes, there is only a 2.77% chance you will hit snake eyes. But if you roll the dice 100,000 times, it is virtually certain snake eyes will come up several thousand times. Right now, policymakers are making decisions that will limit or expand opportunities for the virus to spread and mutate. Most proposals will require weighing costs, benefits, and risks, such as when and how much to reopen the economy or delaying second doses of vaccines. Wearing masks requires none of these calculations. We know masks decrease transmission. Lifting a masking order not only means more people will get sick and die, it also gives the virus more rolls of the dice. That is a fact. The variants we have seen so far do not worry me much. The variants we have not yet seen, yes, they worry me. To increase our risks is simply foolish. And that was, abandoning masks now is a terrible idea. The 1918 pandemic shows why, by John M. Barry, who is the author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. And now, the politics of contempt. by Dr. Robert Frake of Ocean Park, Washington. Any nation that could elect Donald Trump to be its president has a dangerously low view of politics. Donald Trump is the culmination of a long-term destructive trend, the public's utter contempt for politics. By contempt, I don't mean merely extreme frustration or anger over what is happening politically. Such reactions have been apparent in America since our first contested election in 1800. Something new is afoot in our political lives. By contempt, I am describing how many Americans have crossed over a threshold from frustration to despair, from unhappiness to rage, from deep skepticism to corrosive cynicism. Many Americans have lost hope that we can solve our problems using the traditional means of politics. That's a very dangerous development, opening us up to all sorts of anti-constitutional mischief. What is the result of this contempt? At a time when it's imperative for Americans to recover a sense of the high purpose of politics, they elected a man who seemed determined to denigrate it. Trump, in this sense, was a symptom and a cause of the virus now threatening our common life in America. There is a very real sense that Trump's presidency marked the death of the best of American tradition of politics. One of our duties as citizens, regardless of our political affiliations, is to look searchingly and honestly at the nature of that virus, what caused it, what sustains it, and what needs to be done to combat it and ameliorate its effects. Consider Trump's rise and what it says about the state of American politics. Donald Trump ran for president in 2016 with no experience and no obvious qualifications for the job. Over the course of a dozen presidential debates and countless interviews, speeches, and Twitter storms, Trump showed he was unsuited to be president. The former reality television show star proved himself a huckster, a con man, a peddler of conspiracy theories, and a compulsive liar, vindictive and erratic, and staggeringly ignorant of the key political issues. Often his answers amounted to a word salad, a confused mixture of seemingly random and repetitive phrases. All these claims are reasonable verdicts based on cold, hard facts. To many Trump voters, he was a change agent, a street fighter who hit back against his critics many times harder than they hit him, a man who was authentic and not politically correct. To his core supporters, Trump was a wrecking ball against the much-loathed establishment and a man who would drain the swamp. His inexperience and sheer abnormality were perceived as marks in his favor. He wasn't part of the problem. He was an outsider. In his case, it was said, a successful businessman and dealmaker in a nation that perceived politics as broken. How broken? A Washington Post University of Maryland survey in 2017, the year Trump assumed office, revealed a starkly pessimistic view of U.S. politics, widespread distrust of the nation's political leaders and their ability to compromise, and an erosion of pride in the way democracy works in America. A mere 14% said they viewed the ethics and honesty of politicians as excellent or good. 7 out of 10 said the nation's politics have reached a dangerous low point. Mutual contempt between Republicans and Democrats is rapidly rising, and sizable shares of both Democrats and Republicans said the other party stirred feelings of frustration, fear, and anger. Public distrust in our government is near historic lows. 3/4 of Americans believe it is a serious problem that the political system in Washington is not working well enough to produce solutions to the nation's problems. How did we get to that moment? 1, massive demographic and cultural changes, redefining what it means to be American. 2, long-term income stagnation for most workers, provoking middle-class economic anxieties. 3. Ongoing polarization of our political parties at the cost of not solving America's problems, resulting in a loss of trust in the political class. That's how we got to this moment. It's difficult to predict what the future holds in store for us. I'm thinking of Hamlet's "to be or not to be" soliloquy, wherein he pleads for an end to the heartaches and thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, a consummation devoutly to be wished. Would that we Americans could find some sort of consummation regarding the troublesome ongoing issue of contempt. And that was The Politics of Contempt by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. And now, a poem by Carolyn Dunn, These Things. Daytime is when the world pushes its things around. The cable trucks arrive and propel one of their people up and over, under and through the branches of a huge tree. The man in harness up there, plying out stretches of wire, his supervisors circling the area, shouting orders, pulling cable, keeping an eye out for traffic, while overhead, crows and gulls rise in a gyre of indication, and far above them, the first Coast Guard helicopter of the day heads west to practice its maneuvers in order to save the inevitable someone, sometime, under and through, up and out of the sea. Inside, people boot up computers, fill out forms, push papers in front of people, plug in vacuum cleaners, make phone calls to order sandwiches for the lunch seminar, make sandwiches, calm children in a fight over the ownership of a ball, take an old person's pulse, or freshen their glass of water, wonder what and why, check their watches, keep moving, study documentation, nurse a headache, come out the other end of the tunnel, go home. At night, none of this. We pretty much leave things alone at night. Not everybody. Mostly the ones who, in the middle of their lives, are paid to push around our palpable world so all of us can do the constant, curious prying our kind is programmed to do, and which gets us into all the wants and fixes we get into, and which demands an endless, able-bodied crew to provide and extricate us from these things. And that was These Things by Carolyn Dunn. This is Michael McCusker. Engineer for this program is Dylan Hauser Schalk. The vernal equinox is the true beginning of each year, the celebration of one full circle of light and the beginning of another, as the Lakota Sioux people believe, which also heralds the annual KMUN Spring Pledge Drive, which this year courses like a dry stream bed, awaiting the vernal freshet of life-giving green flows of radio protein from its listeners. You can read Anne Frank's diary of hiding out in an attic from the Nazis only so many times during this anxious period of global plague and shut-in quarantine in which our homes act as isolation wards. And the vernal equinox shrieks like a siren for release from the burrow or cave of winter. Thank God for Community Public Radio KMUN and the skeletal staff and volunteers who provide communication, information, and the warmth of comity and candor on the air during this perilous interval of deadly disease afflicting our lives. This spring pledge drive runs from the Ides of March to KMUN's 38th birthday, April 17th. Pledge now. Call 503-325-0010 now. And happy birthday, March 19th to Siri Mirsapasi, which is also the day the Swallows return every year to Mission San Juan Capistrano, and which to me is a personal advent of vernality.